This is a Travel Channel podcast. Check out Discovery Network's complete podcast lineup at discoveychannelradio.com.
There's no city in the world like Los Angeles.
It's more than just a place. It's an idea.
Born of nothing, morphing into a 21st century giant.
The city itself is constantly changing. It's like the magic slate you had as a child. You wrote on it and lifted up, and you wrote something else.
It's the movie town. A dream factory run riot.
You shouldn't be too surprised if it occasionally resembles the bar scene in Star Wars.
It's the city of big ideas.
Pick the fruit off the trees, easy living, paradise.
Spend some time in the city and you'll soon get the drift.
Because I think people that know about it, know about it. People that don't know about it, don't need to know about it.
This is the once and future city of Los Angeles. In 1932, New Yorker journalist Morris Markey observed of Los Angeles, "There's no plausible answer to the question, why did a town spring up here? And why is it so big? But big it is."
The sight of Los Angeles, this great vast ocean of light on the plain below, mesmerized people. You say, how long is this city going to go on? Where it goes on forever. And there it is, this vast, incomprehensible place that yet somehow functions as a city.
This is a city of legendary proportions. Overwhelming, intimidating, exciting. More than 15 million people in five counties with 178 separate cities.
Some cities tell you their story. Hi, this is New York. I'm going to tell you the New York story. You come into Los Angeles and you have to write your own story out of a kit of parts. So Los Angeles demands participation.
Los Angeles has been calling itself the city of the future for about 150 years and has sold itself that way to developers, to health seekers, to industry, to people who come here looking for a better life. So it's ironic and it's kind of perfect.
The real Los Angeles story begins with the settlement of white men.
Well, the key moments in the development of Los Angeles would be September 1781, when it was founded, because it was the first Spanish settlement to be given full Pueblo status, i.e. was founded as a city.
The Spanish dotted the west coast of the New World with settlements. San Gabriel still stands in the suburbs of Los Angeles. A brave party of souls marched 10 miles from San Gabriel and laid out a Pueblo on the banks of the Los Angeles River. They described their future city as a most beautiful garden. Thickets rife with roses, grapevine, and perhaps most alarmingly, bears.
There were only a few hundred people here for the next 40 years or so, at which time Mexico won its independence from Spain and Los Angeles changed into a Mexican town.
That pueblo is now the Mexican tourist quarter, Olvera Street, just off downtown. The daily prayer session at Misión Nuestra Señora Reina de Los Ángeles. A direct link still to its Mexican heritage. Tourists still trade for trinkets. What they don't realize is Olvera Street was a marketing exercise dreamt up in the 1930s.
People come here, go to restaurants, eat delicious Mexican food, buy Mexican curios, have a good time, listen to the music, meet friends, go to the Plaza Church for weddings, baptisms, and other celebrations.
Mexico ceded California to the young United States for the princely sum of $15 million. White settlers wasted no time making land grabs.
And a fantasy heritage was created in which to sell this area.
49ers digging for gold swelled California's population, and LA's rancheros made fat profits feeding them. The first train arrival in 1885 lifted the city's prospects even further. Times were very good indeed.
And then you go into the early 1900s, when between 1900 and 1930, approximately 1.5 million new Los Angelinos come in. So the city, in effect, enters the 20th century with about 100,000 people, and by 1930s is a major American city. So even though the foundations of the city go back to the Spanish period, the 18th century, the closer you get to the present, the more accelerated the growth becomes.
At the turn of the century, Los Angeles was starved of the one scarce commodity it needed to become a truly major metropolis, water. One estimate claimed the city would sustain only 500,000 people with its current supply, the erratic Los Angeles River. A grand plan was hatched, the most audacious ever undertaken by a city in the world, it would drain a whole valley of water some 350 miles away. And in so doing, began a feud which is still being fought to this day.
You know, if a city is a great omelet, you have to break some eggs to make it. So that doesn't make Mulholland a criminal or the people of Los Angeles who authorized this construction criminals. It just means a tragic conflict of two goods.
This is the lifeblood of Los Angeles, water. And this man was the ringleader of a plan that changed the course of Californian history. His name, William Mulholland. City elders wanted progress and expansion, but its water supply was a shambles.
Los Angeles had some people who came to this place who were big, big thinkers and thinking of big ideas like, we see a huge metropolis here. Even though there's no water here, we're going to figure out a way to grow this metropolis.
These big thinkers looked north to the Sierra Nevada snowcaps and the lush Owens Valley sitting beneath them.
A lot of smart people who had some big ideas and then did some projects that everybody said were impossible and pulled them off.
Owens Valley farmers were in the dark. LA's water and power department bought up their land leases and water entitlements. By the time they twigged, it was too late. The city's water grab was complete. The federal government endorsed the actions, and William Mulholland began one of the greatest engineering feats of the century, a gravity-fed aqueduct which turned dry LA into a lush paradise.
This is the vein that the fangs of the wicked city of Los Angeles stuck into the lifeline, the lifeblood of the Owens Valley.
Author Pat Morrison, a longtime L.A. resident, still feels pangs of guilt when she looks over the now barren Owens Valley.
Once the farmers here realized the implications of the aqueduct, that it was taking away literally the lifeblood of their livelihood, the water that made their farms possible, they reacted in some cases violently. Dynamite was used at several points along the aqueduct, and when their children heard this man-made thunder, they cheered. They thought, we are fighting back.
A fight still bitter in the memory.
As recently as 2 years ago, into the 21st century, when a new gate was put up, someone stuck a knife into the wet concrete and wrote, "This is the knife in Mulholland's back."
Historian Kevin Starr takes a more sanguine approach to the water story.
You know, the ancient Etruscans used to have a ceremony saying that at the founding of every city, a sacrifice is involved. Things are lost when you found a city. And a city needs water, and what was lost was, of course, the Owens Valley.
To Starr, it was a balancing act between two goods.
The goods of the farmers, to have their land irrigated and to pursue their lives, and the good of Los Angeles to become a great metropolitan region. Those two goods clashed with each other.
A dry lake bed now stands where once there was water 30 feet deep.
It is as if Los Angeles stuck a straw, a soda straw, in the Owens Valley and has sucked it dry over 90 years.
Mulholland opened the aqueduct November 5th, 1913. There were no dramatic speeches. He simply said, "There it is. Take it." Water allowed the city to grow. Oil discovered in 1892 allowed it to prosper. 2,500 individual homeowners dug wells to tap into the black gold. LA was a pincushion. More than 100 years on, little has changed. Many houses in LA are still bought and sold with oil rights attached. Come the beginning of the 20th century, Los Angeles was a rural community, offering cheap land. Developers saw potential, and the boldest was Venice Beach. Known today as a muscle and circus-strewn sidewalk, this daily carnival of LA's wild side is an international draw card. But venture just a couple of blocks behind the noise and color of the beach, you'll find a hidden gem.
We do try to keep it a secret in LA because it's so unique. And we enjoy life here so much.
Venice was the brainchild of Abbot Kinney, who imagined block after block of canals lined with beautiful houses.
Well, I think it took great imagination and a certain amount of courage. I don't know how much skill, though. And I think he was looking for the buck, you know, because he sold these lots in here for $100 each, and there are close to 400 lots.
Angelinos rode the electric train to Venice, enjoying their little patch of Europe in the desert. This was L.A. in its leisurely age of innocence. The sun shone brightly on the West Coast, a fact not lost on the movie men.
They looked around and they realized in Southern California they had extraordinary weather. They could film about 11 months a year. Secondly, they had a landscape where they had both desert, mountains, forests. They had every kind of landscape they needed. Thirdly, they were far away from the Edison people who claimed patent rights to the motion picture industry, and close enough to Mexico in case they had to get out of town. And Los Angeles becomes, as Harry Carr, the Los Angeles Times columnist, calls it in the 1930s, Los Angeles City of Dreams.
And America needed to dream. Film studios cranked out movie after movie to feed an audience desperate to escape the realities of the Depression. L.A. was absorbing a lost generation forced off the farm. It was America's second chance.
You know, F. Scott Fitzgerald once said, there are no second acts in American lives. In Los Angeles, was telling people at the same time Fitzgerald was saying that, come to Los Angeles, you can have a second, third, fourth act.
L.A. has always been kind of a city that sees itself as a set. You have this constant reinvention of this city, and there's a certain excitement about that, a certain sense of individuality.
During the 19-teens and 20s, Los Angeles was less a city and more a series of interconnected townships nestled between orange groves. Space was never an issue. When Cecil B. DeMille arrived, he was just a minor distraction in a city busy growing oranges and drilling for oil. But he and fellow filmmakers to come saw other things.
If the movie industry had chosen another city, Los Angeles would be a kind of Chicago. It would be a big, solid, middle-class, quasi-Midwestern city. But it would not have attracted the important people who came here from the motion picture industry and internationalized this city in the 1930s.
America swooned, not just for the film stars, but the location.
Los Angeles was one of the most unspoiled, most beautiful places in the world. I am told that the smell of the orange blossoms was absolutely overwhelming as you drove down Sunset Boulevard.
Hollywood historian Laurie Jacobson says the movie people and their antics horrified the locals.
It was a dry town, it was a conservative town, and these liberals, who were kind of freewheeling and young and wild in the streets, moved in and changed the complexion of this town forever.
This was the glory days of filmmaking. Studio bosses ran the town, and everybody was making a buck.
It was a madhouse. It was an absolute madhouse. And I think the residents didn't find it so funny in the beginning, but when the money and the tourism started pouring in, then they were quite delighted with it.
An enterprising real estate salesman erected a large sign on the L.A. foothills, and a legend was born.
You can walk down any street in Hollywood and walk in the footsteps of history.
Hollywood's history's footsteps echo loudest at the Chateau Marmont.
Here at the Chateau Marmont, a magnificent hotel that goes back over 80 years, almost every celebrity you can think of stayed here. Greta Garbo, Marilyn Monroe, Howard Hughes used to love to rent the apartment with the balcony, and he stood out there with binoculars and picked women at the pool here, saying, get that girl and bring her up here. Oh, and honey, they came.
Studio boss Harry Cohen declared to his stars, if you must get into trouble, make sure it's at the Marmont.
When Garbo stayed here, the people in the suite next door to her were making so much noise that she came down here in the lobby and slept undisturbed all night because it was that kind of a hotel. Life and death, love, marriage, divorce, hiding from the press, hiding from your studio, hiding from your wife. It all happened here.
In the lead up to World War II, Los Angeles was awash with optimism. Los Angeles was also awash with water. Its erratic river had once again created problems for the city. It became a vast floodplain, changing course, threatening lives, damaging real estate. And in Los Angeles, to damage real estate is a sin. The river had to pay.
The river was, as the city grew, viewed not as a source of water, but as a monster, as a killer. The city fathers imagined a great city where none had been conceived of before. If we can imagine a city into existence, we can imagine a river out of existence.
March 1938, a river which for 11 months of the year is little more than a trickle, bursts into life. An uncontrolled torrent
which took 100 lives, Los Angeles had had enough of its wayward water course.
Essentially, by building the aqueduct, they turned the river into an ex-wife, a non-river. And you know what happens with ex-wives. You don't want to see them, you don't want to hear from them, and all they are is trouble.
The city called in the Army Corps of Engineers.
The irony is that the Army Corps of Engineers is charged with control of the navigable waterways of the United States. This has never been, except for perhaps a boat this long, a navigable waterway.
The engineers determined to tame the river. 17,000 men poured 2 million cubic yards of concrete.
The river's great sin was taking real estate off the market by being so capricious. And that's why it had to be channeled and corseted and girdled and put in this concrete straitjacket.
The LA Times called it a war to free cities from peril.
This is what Los Angeles does to its rivers. We cement them over, try to prevent the floods, and keep them from recharging the groundwater.
By the turn of World War II, Los Angeles had shed its agricultural heritage and emerged an industrial powerhouse. America was gearing for war, and LA's million-strong labor force was ready to manufacture the hardware. From the San Fernando Valley, mass-produced aircraft delivered Uncle Sam's message to the Pacific and European theaters.
You have the great companies of Douglas, Lockheed, Northrop, North American Aviation. So you have set in motion already the elements of the great garrison city in a garrison state that Southern California became during the Second World War.
Women in particular relished the economic freedom, female industrial muscle matching their male counterparts. But the real revolution was for Black America. Southern domestic servants migrated to become independent LA salary earners.
The 1940s and 1950s represent a period of profound change for Black Los Angeles, with the influx of hundreds of thousands of African Americans from the South seeking greater employment opportunities, lower barriers to home ownership, less racial violence and racial intimidation. And I have to say that in most cases, they probably found it.
Los Angeles' promise of a new life was stronger than ever.
So you have a creation of Los Angeles as an epicenter of African-American culture and society in a city that previously had only a very small number of African-Americans.
In fact, L.A. boasted one of the highest rates of Black homeownership in the country, and in countless studies, the most influential being the Urban League's 1964 study, they ranked Los Angeles as the best city in which African-Americans could live in the country.
But trouble was brewing in the suburbs. In 1965, just months after the city is proclaimed superior for Black America, riots erupt in Watts, beginning a pattern of violence which lasts almost 30 years.
The spark in the Watts riots was an interaction between California Highway Patrol and a young motorist named Marquette Fry. And, you know, if you just looked at it as a trigger, it wouldn't make sense. But if you see this as a trigger invoking a long-standing pattern of LAPD and CHP abuse of Black residents, you can understand why it takes off like it does.
35 dead, 3,000 arrested. Historian Dr. Josh Sides believes Watts was inevitable for young African-Americans flexing muscles born of anger and inequality.
Keep in mind that the majority of participants in the Watts riots of 65 were youngsters, 20 and under. Their children have a very different set of expectations. They don't compare their lives and their opportunities to what their parents had in Louisiana or Mississippi. They compare their opportunities to what their white peers and Latino peers and Asian peers in Los Angeles have. And by that standard, they're pretty frustrated.
Life on the Los Angeles streets was slowly changing. Not that Hollywood noticed. The LA movie machine focused on an entirely different cultural wave. Surf was up, and the world was catching the wave. A Woody with a Malibu in the back was a ticket to baby boomer freedom. The Beach Boys, Chan and Dean and Gidget, just some of the names in the vanguard. Surfin' Safari California style had arrived.
Surf culture is the music. I mean, how many other sports or activities have their own music? The song Wipeout. Everyone knows Wipeout.
Jim Fuller co-wrote the classic track Wipeout, a guitar anthem of innocence and fun.
You could tell at the time that it was going to be big. All the good times I'm playing down here and the people, that it used to be so much more free and a lot more fun. We were actually fairly young and we didn't really understand what the impact was until a couple of years later. Yeah. And then, of course, after these many years later, when it still goes over very big. Yeah.
Thank you. Come the 70s and 80s, L.A. struggled with phenomenal growth. It became the nation's smog capital. Freeways went up, but the energy crisis threatened to bring the city down. America's first black mayor, Tom Bradley, was voted in, but industry had already elected to move out. Unemployment and the homeless increased. The glamour of Hollywood was tarnished by the pimps and hookers on Sunset Boulevard. South of downtown, once proud neighborhoods lived in fear of race and gang violence.
Matter of fact, in the 80s, probably was the worst that we had ever seen. I think there was 2.5 gang-related murders in the Los Angeles area per night.
In 1992, Los Angeles erupts again.
It was a brutal time, and I was on the streets.
Hollywood couldn't have scripted the city's real drama. While a judge acquitted 5 police for beating Rodney King, the residents of South Central declared them guilty and administered their own street-style justice.
So we're standing here at the intersection of Florence Normandy, which was one of the flashpoints during the 1992 riots and, in many ways, I think, contributed to Los Angeles' notoriety with regards to race relations.
After 3 days of anarchy, President George Bush Sr. called in the National Guard. Radio and TV broadcast his chilling orders. From daybreak, they were to shoot to kill anyone on the streets.
My God, it was impossible for the people on the street who were doing all of the damage to be listening to the radio or television and getting the information.
Actor Edward James Olmos feared a bloodbath. Helpless and at a loss, he did the only thing he could think of. Impulsively, he grabbed a broom, walked onto the streets in the pre-dawn, and began to sweep.
I just got out there and started sweeping just because I had given up hope. So I started to sweep down the street, and then one person saw me and joined me. And then before 6 o'clock, there was at least 16 to 20 kids, and they were all kids that had their brooms and were standing alongside of me sweeping.
By 9 o'clock, there were thousands. Almost as spontaneous people power won the day. The riots were over and not a shot had been fired. Almost didn't sweep away the city's problems, but it was a start.
It left a lot of people with a tremendous sense of hope, and it was just, what can I tell you?
In little more than 10 short years since the L.A. riots, the city has been transformed. The black ghettos have opened up to Latino neighbors. L.A. is still a city of distinct neighborhoods, but the mix is getting better.
The United States has never really been a melting pot. It's always been like a huge salad bowl, where the lettuce stays the lettuce, the tomato stays the tomato. But basically, as time's gone on now, it's kind of tossed now. It's more and more, and there's nothing better than a well-tossed salad. So it's becoming a better place to live with every day that goes by.
For the most part, I think people are figuring out the best way to live together is to talk together, to hear each other's concerns, and then work towards solutions.
In some ways, Los Angeles has been burdened by being the antithesis of New York. Of New York, people say it's a great place to visit, but I wouldn't want to live there. This is a difficult place to visit. It's very broad and spread out, but to live here is a marvel.
Pat Morrison says the people who really appreciate Los Angeles are those who recognize its individuality.
This is not a vertical city. People who are accustomed to European and East Coast cities in the United States get a little unnerved by Los Angeles.
Not as unnerved as when the ground moves. In the Los Angeles basin, there are more than 100 fault lines, each a disaster in the making. It's nature's double-edged sword. L.A. is only perfect because of its faults.
The faults push up the mountains, clouds come in off of the ocean, hit the mountains, and drop their water, goes into the ground, percolates along the faults, and comes back up along fault-controlled springs. So we have groundwater here because of the faults, we have rain here because of the faults, and without it, we'd be as much of a desert as Nevada.
Seismologist Dr. Lucy Jones is a rare commodity, a fifth-generation Angeleno. She hunts fault lines. When the earth shakes, she wants to know why.
The earthquake that moved this 20 feet was larger than any nuclear bomb that we've ever created.
1994. L.A. is rudely awakened by the first large quake to hit urban USA for 60 years. A few seconds at 6.7 on the Richter scale produced 466 fires. 18 people died. According to Lucy Jones, you can be 100% certain another large quake will hit Los Angeles.
Every one of these hills, think an earthquake. Now, they don't happen very often, every 20,000 years, 10,000 years, something like that. But this is a dozen earthquakes waiting to happen between here and downtown.
L.A. is changing. Once joked as 100 suburbs in search of a city, it is now a force to be reckoned with. Its Philharmonic is one of the best in the world, housed in one of the world's most remarkable buildings. The Getty Art Museum, lounging on the Hollywood Hills, a must-see Los Angeles icon.
It has culture, but it's not about a prepackaged sense of culture. Los Angelinos are rather casual about their culture.
We think we are the prototype. We think at the dawn here of the 21st century, there's no other city like Los Angeles that has these kinds of assets.
It's that the United States sees through the prism of Los Angeles its sophisticated, multicultural identity. So basically, through Los Angeles, America is probing its world identity.